Thank God it's Friday.
More like
Friday.
Oh shit, it's Wednesday, and therefore time for a new junk food cinema brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Wednesday.
Thank God it's Wednesday.
Dot com.
Everything else is bullshit. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He has the boogie-woogie fever and the rock and roll flu, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Friday.
Thank God it's Friday.
I am so excited this week.
I am really excited that this movie exists.
This is a movie that has been with me since childhood. I've wanted to cover it for a long time. I revisited a year and a half ago just to check before I even mentioned its existence to you.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh yeah, we can cover that. And I was waiting for the right time to do it, and I was trying to slot it in for something. And when Summer of 78 came up, I'm like, yes. This is happening. And I kept mentioning it to you, and you just kept nodding going, all right, yeah, we can cover that one, yeah.
And I think it's because the last time you recommended that we watch something for the show, to be fair, it was Trax. So
I was a little
gun-shy. You were right and wrong at the same time, which is an amazing feat in and of itself.
It is Schrodinger's movie, man. Trax is a thing. It is a thing that both exists and doesn't exist, that is good and both absolutely not good.
I mean, not to start off the show at the sidebar. I was tumbling down the IMDb rabbit hole the other day and found Dave's World, Dave Anderson's TV show.
Yeah.
And didn't know that on Dave's World, one of his friends was played by Shadow Stevens. So there's that. What the hell are we talking about? Well, you should go to our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, really like the show enough to want to know what we were actually talking about?
This is true, because the only place to actually find out what we were talking about is to go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content. And if you graduate to the $5 an episode level and above, you get access to... The Deep Dish.
The Deep Dish.
Which is a monthly extra episode where we go after something a little bit weirder, a little bit more niche.
And a little harder to find.
And a little bit more full of Shadow Stevens.
Well, sometimes.
There is 100% more Shadow Stevens in this month's Deep Dish than we've ever covered before.
Or anybody has ever covered before,
anyone has ever covered before. So check that out. But this week's episode, continuing Summer of 1978, is a film that reminds me a lot of some of the other films, some very specific other classics of junk food cinema.
Well, this is a movie that first and foremost is from Brian and I shared favorite genre. Like, if we had to pick a genre that was a favorite that we agreed on, it would be It Happened One Night. We love It Happened One Night. And this is a movie where we start just after sunset and we plow through and disco until dawn.
It satisfies two of the circles of my Venn diagram. One is, yes, absolutely, It Happened One Night. The other is the genre of time capsule movies.
Oh, God, yes. In fact, the thing that I find so fascinating about this movie, and the thing we're going to be, one of the big things we're going to be excited about to talk about tonight, is that this movie, we have not had a movie with this kind of cast since we talked about Roadside Prophets a few years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Because there are three types of people in this movie. One, actors you have never heard from again since. Two, legendary musicians and singers and songwriters. And three, Jeff Goldblum. That's it. Like, this movie, like, no, you're not going to be like, oh, hey, it's that actor from... No. You're going to be like, holy shit, is that... Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And there are so many interesting and great musicians. There is a musician in this who started as an actress, failed as an actress, and then became a legendary musician. And we'll get to her. And then you have Jeff motherfucking Goldblum.
I'm in full agreement that he deserves his own category in many different things. But yeah, we talk about time capsule movies. We talk about slice of life movies. And if there is one movie that is a big honkin' slice of pineapple upside down Coke cake, It's Thank God It's Friday.
Thank God It's Friday. Everyone's favorite night when the calmest thing happening is on the dance floor.
I'm Papa. I'm out with an old man.
I'm not looking for action. What I want is a nice girl.
Would you like to dance?
Maybe it was fate. Maybe it was just Friday. But it was a night none of them will ever forget. Thank God It's Friday. Rated PG.
Yeah, this movie is very much, in fact, one of the things I found fascinating about it and why I really wanted to revisit it on the show is the reason you should look back at this is this came from an era in which there were a whole mess of movies that came out, and we've talked about several of them, that have celebrated disco culture.
Yeah.
And it's like, here's what's great about the discos. Here's what's great about roller discos. You know, here's what's great about what's going on in pop culture at this time. And this is a movie that's like, hey, you want to see a movie that's great about discos? Yeah. Because this isn't it. Because we fucking hate discos. And we're going to show you why discos fucking suck. And you're going to feel good at the end of this movie. But we don't actually like discos.
Yeah, and it's funny. I believe, so I'm watching this movie and I had to text you. And I believe what I said was, I'm in love with Thank God It's Friday because it's like if Skate Town USA were competently made but somehow still sucked in all the best ways.
Oh, yeah. No, because the thing is this movie was not a very well-made movie.
Not so much.
In fact, the best terrible thing about this movie is, see, you've only watched it once, right? You haven't gone through a second time, or did you?
No, I did not.
Okay,
I didn't do the cut where it's forwards and backwards at the same time, if that's what you're asking.
No. Next time you watch it, pay attention to all the extras in this movie, because they are some of the worst extras you've ever seen. Nobody is dancing on beat. Nobody, like, there are people standing over to the side that are clearly like, hey, I'm in a movie. I'm going to, like, act like nobody ever acts like in a dance club. Like, everybody in the background, it's a fucking mess. It's almost like they just gave Coke to everybody and said, just pretend you're at the disco, and they had no idea what that meant. It is glorious when you start paying attention to the shit going on around the actors.
Yeah, there is that. And it also features one of my favorite bands of the era, which is Earth, Wind, and Terrible ADR. because there is a scene where the two girls get in the car right after visiting the hot dog stand that looks like an actual hot dog, which is something I've never actually seen in the wild, and I really hope that someday I get to. And so we first meet Jennifer and Maddie. There's a whole conversation about how could you eat at a time like this that goes back and forth like four times, and no one's mouth is moving. Not one time is anyone's mouth moving. Oh, no. And their mouth, like, and it's like fully framed. Their faces are in the shot. And then it happens again when two teen girls sneak into the bathroom and one of them says, it smells like my brother's room. But again, we're looking at both of their mouths and no one is actually talking. So bad ADR skating around this place like Patrick Swayze.
We need some comedy in here. Although, see, the one thing I'm a little, you know, I when I said no one you've ever heard of again, there is one actress notable in this movie that's
notable,
not Jeff Goldblum.
But 12th billed.
I know.
Insanely, she is 12th billed.
And she barely does anything in this movie.
She needs to be lifted up that cast list where she belongs.
Yeah, yeah. This is, by the way, we're talking about Deborah Winger. Deborah Winger shows up in this and is awesome. Deborah Winger, who we've covered on the show before, who we love, is kind of in this movie.
I would like to check the Earth residency status of anyone who doesn't love Deborah Winger.
Yeah, but the thing is you want to talk about, like, here they have clearly who the best actress in the movie is.
Yeah.
And she's given the one role where she has nothing to do. Her character is just a stick in the mud who doesn't want to go to a disco and is kind of stuck at a disco and wants to meet a guy, but is just fixated on what they're wearing. Like, looking for just the right kind of guy who's dressed in the right clothing, because she's entirely shallow like that. And she just kind of sits around moping for the entirety of the evening, dodging anyone that talks to her because of how they're dressed, until some guy bumps into her wearing a cotton t-shirt and a leather jacket.
Man, the greatest part, I think, about doing Summer of 78 is that we get to talk about all these clothes.
All these
sartorial disasters that we get to discuss.
So I think we're jumping right into Leatherman then?
Leatherman! Okay, we have already talked about... We have already talked about Can't Stop the Music, and then we're introduced again to a character called Leatherman, so I assume he's...
Can't Stop the Music happens was made 2 years after this.
Oh, no, I know, but I assume that this is the same Leatherman, that anyone named Leatherman is in the fucking Village People.
Yeah, no, because this guy's wearing brown leather, and Leatherman from the Village People wears black leather and supposedly rides motorcycles.
This is true.
That Leatherman works at a toll booth and then becomes a member of the Village People. This is the Leatherman who works at a department store and dresses in all leather and then dances the night away.
Yes, and just tries
gloriously
tries to teach a young looking, not really Josh Leonard, how to dance as well,
while dancing across the discoing across the roofs, the roof of cars.
Yeah,
this movie glorious. Is special.
Here's the thing. Let's talk a little bit about the plot, so called, of Thank God It's Friday. It's several different stories about people who are coming to the hottest disco in town, which I believe is called Zoo. And they're all coming there with different intentions and different groups, hoping for different outcomes. In fact, it actually reminded me a lot of Can't Hardly Wait.
Well, Can't Hardly Wait definitely lifts from this.
I would have to agree with
it's
that.
It's definite inspiration. But also, yeah, no, the movies this is most like is Can't Hardly Wait and Dazed and Confused. Like, this is the one night party thing, but the party is the disco. And there are all these completely different stories that just kind of bump into each other along the way. But there is no actual narrative. No. Like, you would think there's a narrative. You would think that, oh, hey, there's this big dance contest and that's what everybody is involved. No. There's only like two groups that care at all about the dance contest. No one else in the film cares about the dance contest at all. You have characters just trying to get laid. You have people just trying to have a good time and rekindle their relationship. You've got, you know, you have the actual high school girls trying to win the dance contest so they can go and to the Kiss concert so they can afford to see Kiss. But there's no actual genuine narrative to it. It's just about flowing through a single night. And I love that story when it's done well. And here it actually is.
That's true. The story itself, or the narrative or lack thereof that they're pulling off, they pull off very well.
And it's enjoyable, and it's carried through by the charisma of several of the people doing it. I think, first of all, the shining star of this movie is, of course, Jeff fucking Goldblum.
Young Jeff Goldblum in this movie is so goddamn hot. He is like a smokehouse cut of beef. Like, oh my God.
And not just that. He's playing the sleazy nightclub owner who's got a deal. He's got a game he plays with the DJ where the DJ picks somebody from the crowd that he doesn't think Jeff Goldblum can nail. And Jeff Goldblum spends the entire night trying to nail her. And this time, the DJ has seen that this older couple who is there on their anniversary, they were just eating at a fine restaurant across the street, and the woman's like, I want to go to one of those newfangled disco things, it would be fun. And the guy's like, I don't want to fucking go, I want to go and crash out in front of fucking the Tonight Show. I was like, no, don't be such a stick in the mud. And they decide to go, and they go, and
don't be such a ridiculous Jewish stereotype, let's go, which he spends a majority of the movie being a ridiculous Jewish stereotype.
There are a pair of those in this movie. In fact, one of them is played by a Lebanese actor, but we will get to him as well.
If Robert Forster could play an Arab terrorist, the universe is wide open.
The universe is a little weird 40 years ago. Let's just lay that out.
I think we're all...
The universe is a little weird and racist at times.
Ratified.
Yeah.
At that point, yes.
So this is a movie in which there's really no other story to it. Like, that is the main through line, and then every little group has their own story. Most of those stories are as simple as guy has shown up to the disco to meet his computer date.
Which is actually kind of... I was not expecting in a 1978 movie. He's like, you know, I'm here to meet this girl. I was matched. It's a blind date, one of those computer things. And I'm like, how does that work in 1978? Because nobody has a home computer.
Oh, no. Computer dating in this era. Oh, great. Okay. Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
Yeah. I may have set this one up.
You may have. So computer dating was very weird back in the day. You actually filled out forms and sent the forms in, and then they would kick you back information. Oddly enough, in a bizarre, what the fuck were they thinking 25 years ago thing, we had a weird computer dating thing at our school that a company came in and had, you could pay to find this, and you would get a, we all got a feedback of who our matching people were. And in a very odd thing, the top response on my form that I got back, because I was like, fuck it, I'm single, what the fuck? And I'm like, oh, who is this girl? And I lean over to my buddy, I'm like, who the hell is this? This guy who sat next to me in class, he's like, dude, that's my girlfriend. And I'm like, did you match with her?
Your buddy's girlfriend was Barry Bostick. That's hilarious. I didn't realize that.
That is correct. So, but yeah, but so you would just, it would be, you. So what they did is they filled out a form and it was, you know, some key puncher punched it in and it spit out this little like printout of this is who you should be going out with. So yeah, no, it's not at all like computer dating now where you'd actually cycle through profiles and contact. No, you'd be set up on a blind date with whoever this person is who most matched you. And it was notoriously goofy. And it's why everybody joked about dating online was because computer dating had been such a flop culturally and wasn't something that was considered to work out. So yeah, it's closer. Like, I guess eHarmony is kind of like that these days, that they kind of pair you up with people. I guess I have not dated in decades.
Well, as someone who has and got married and had a baby as a result, it was not, this is your one and only match, good luck. It was, you know, a cycle of profiles that you would
go through. Work totally. So this guy has been spit out this thing. He has no idea who he's meeting and is looking around for this girl, Shirley. And of course, the whole thing with his arc, which is never really fully completed, like it is, but it isn't. He's just an insufferable guy with little man syndrome.
Yeah.
Who says this, somebody bumps into him and they always apologize. And he's like, he always says, you better bet you're sorry.
Yeah. You bet your sweet ass you're sorry. He's New Jersey as fuck. It's like, yeah, somebody mopped the floor at the Bada Bing and whatever was left in the bucket is this guy. Yeah,
that is a very good.
He's way so to fucking Jersey. It's ridiculous.
And he's a jerk.
He's a dickhead.
And he ends up, his whole storyline is he ends up running into his date is actually taller than him.
Yeah.
But is this sweet older lady who's a teacher who just wants to go out and meet a nice guy. And she's really kind of taken aback because she's like, I specifically said I want someone in government. He's like, I'm a garbage man. A garbage man. He's like, I don't handle the stuff. I just drive the truck. And she's bothered by that. But the interesting thing about this is he's so bothered by this because he instantly assumes it's because he's short. Like, yeah, he's got this chip on his shoulder. And that's what I find interesting about it. As insufferable as he is, it's really great character work because none of it is ever spoken, but you know exactly who this guy is, and they fucking nail that guy. And that guy was at every fucking dance club, you know, known to man throughout history.
See, I feel like in this era, you have to be really careful with phrases like chip on his shoulder, because that could mean that Eric Estrada is sitting on his shoulder. So
why wasn't Eric Estrada in this movie?
That is a great fucking question.
Eric Estrada should have played Leatherman. Oh, you see it, don't you?
Well, I see it, and it's another one of those moments where I hear what you say, and I think, on what other podcast are you going to hear a sentence like, Eric Estrada should have played Leatherman?
And that's us.
That's us. Thanks for being patrons.
So let's talk about what's really, really interesting about this film, like, about the real attraction to this, like, why should I watch this movie? Well, this movie is loaded with 70s and early 80s icons, people who are legendary singers.
Yeah.
Like, of course, the big ones that are advertised in this are the Commodores. And so, of course, the one Commodore who has almost no lines and is barely on screen, but you see him and you see him perform is, of course, Lionel Richie.
Is it Lionel Richie we're looking for on screen?
Hello? It's Lionel Richie we're looking for. Hey, oh, there he is!
And don't look for him much appearing with the Commodores, because this movie represents the only on-screen appearance of the Commodores, which is a running gag throughout the movie that the DJ is being harassed by I don't know, not the club owner, because that's Jeff Goldblum.
No, it's the radio station guy. It's the head of the radio station who's having them do a live broadcast. This DJ, it's his first time doing a live broadcast. He's doing it from the booth of here. It's his big break.
And he got the gig by promising to have the Commodores play, and they are running late, and their equipment manager, driver, keeps getting pulled over by cops, and it's sort of a comedy of errors, and you don't know if the Commodores are actually going to show up, except that in the credits it specifically says, and featuring the Commodores.
But they show up pretty early, but they're like, man, we got a problem. We ain't got no instruments.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, no problem, man. Who's bringing your instruments? And then, of course, the DJ knows the guy, and the guy is super unreliable.
Yeah.
And so that leads to another side character that you will completely forget about every time he's off screen. Like, he's just, he does his thing, and then he vanishes, and you're like, oh, I've completely forgotten about that subplot. But so the thing that's interesting is that DJ has corralled the Commodores, and he's being harassed by a local singer played by none other than Donna Summer.
The fucking queen of disco. And what I dig about this movie is that it came out when disco was still big. So it's like, again, just a perfect slice of life, a perfect time capsule movie, because this is a movie that features the queen of disco in the era where people were still going to discos. In fact, it was Zoo, which is the name of the disco in the movie, was shot at a nightclub called Osco's, which had four dance floors and was famous for being a labyrinth of just disco nuttiness. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the teenage girl. So one of the other subplots of this movie. Well, let's get Donna Summer for a second. Donna Summer is great in this. Yeah. She's really acting her ass off. And her whole thing is she's just trying to get to the DJ booth to get the DJ to play her single. And the DJ's having nothing of it. Wants nothing to do with this girl. Keeps kicking her out. And she's being a little bit of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
She's kind of being a dickhole.
She's not so much taking the no for the answer.
And that's, again, one of the things I love about this movie is this movie is really, really cynical. It's super cynical about disco culture and everything involved with this. There is no element of this story that is pure and untainted in some way. Like, every single aspect of this story involves our characters being kind of shitty. And so Donna Summer sneaks in various ways, gets really snotty with him when he won't put her on the radio, and only redeems herself when the Commodores don't have their instruments. They can't play yet. It's midnight and he's got to go live. And she just steps on the floor and starts singing a song that, oddly enough, is not considered like the big centerpiece song of this movie, but is the biggest hit out of this movie, Last Dance.
So let's dance.
And when you see her in this movie, like, no matter what you think about disco, because I know there's the infamous backlash against disco, but no matter what you think of the genre, Donna Summer's voice is fucking unreal.
Well,
incredible.
Donna Summer's was always amazing, and Last Dance is such a great song.
Yeah.
And in fact, isn't Last Dance one of the disco throwbacks that's in Can't Hardly Wait?
It very well may be. That's a good,
I'm not certain if it, or I might be confusing it with one of the others, so she starts singing, it saves the day. The instruments show up, the Commodores can play. The Commodores play a song that's not their hit, because they already played their big hit for the dancers barely in the movie earlier with Brick House. It's like, wait, the Commodores aren't playing Brick House? That's weird. But
I liked the song that they did play in this
movie. It is good, but it's not Brick House.
No, you know what? It's not Brick House.
There's a bunch of, you know what? The soundtrack is actually really cool.
Oh yeah.
There's some neat stuff on it. One of my favorite little, here's another little like connection of this movie. There is a song on here by Cuba Gooding.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Cuba Gooding. Now this was before he, you know, took his legal name as Cuba Gooding Sr.
Right.
Because his son turned out to be relatively famous as well. But yes, Cuba Gooding Sr., a.k.a. in the soundtrack, Cuba Gooding has one of his songs on here. Because Cuba Gooding Jr.'s dad was a singer.
I did not know this.
Motown and then disco. And then, of course, we talked about Last Dance. We've got to get into talking about an actor in this movie who is a legend in his own right. He is one of the early gay legends. His name is Paul Jabara. He was a Lebanese American who here is essentially playing a Jewish stereotype, as we were talking about earlier. He's this guy who with the, you know, who has a problem seeing and he's keeps taking off his glasses and just wants to get laid. He's just trying to get laid. And the thing about him is he acted 25 times. He's in stuff like that, that you guys may have seen, like Lords of Flatbush. Did a number of other things over the years, but he's more of a legend, in the music community, which I find fascinating. He wrote Last Dance for this movie. Okay. He wrote a couple of other Donna Summers hits. He wrote, several songs for Bette Midler, particularly for her movie, The Rose. And then with his buddy, Paul Schaefer, he wrote a little gay anthem called It's Raining Men.
Yeah.
So it's so weird that like one of the small characters in this movie is played by a guy who had such an impact on the culture. He was one of the early losses. He died in 1992 from complications from AIDS. Did a lot of stuff with theater. In fact, one of my favorite weird little oddities about Paul Jabara is that he played as Frankenfurter in the LA version of the Rocky Horror Picture Show when their cast member playing Frankenfurter went off to star in the movie because he replaced Tim Curry and apparently did an amazing job. So this guy was all over the place and did all sorts of amazing stuff. And his life was just snuffed out. But here he's really likable and gets like one of the more interesting, rewarding side stories of this movie, and in which he ends up, he's got his glasses off the whole time because he wants girls to pick him up, won't pick him up with his glasses, can't see, wanders into a stairwell and gets stuck. And then, of course, later on, these two young girls slip Leatherman's dance partner into the stairwell, knowing that they're locking her in because they're kind of evil.
And this is the part I think the writers of Can't Hardly Wait specifically took from this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Is that he's spending the whole night trying to get laid. Suddenly, out of nowhere, this girl is totally okay taking him home. He's as surprised as anyone else. And he's like, okay, well, wait here. And he goes into the stairwell that they've already established. If you go in there, you'll get locked out. And he goes in there and it's like, oh, no. It's like it's exactly what happens to Seth Green in Can't Hardly Wait.
Except that now this dance girl gets stuck in there. And then, of course, they end up dancing the night away together in a stairwell.
Yep.
And whether they get out or not, we don't know. But they end up dancing together and it's sweet and happy. Now I want to talk about the final legend that's in this movie, in terms of music legends, is the teenage girl who locks him in the stairwell. There are two girls. One went off to be an actress and a director, but never really made a huge mark. And the other was Terry Nunn, who you guys might go, wait, that name sounds familiar. And you'll try to remember what movies you've seen her in and then realize you know her because she's the lead singer of Berlin and that you know her song Take My Breath Away from Top Gun. Because if there's any of you out there who don't know Top Gun, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast.
Seriously.
So she was the lead singer of Berlin. She tried to become an actress. It never took. And then she got offered the chance to sing for this group, and they became huge. So this movie has Lionel Richie, Donna Summer, Paul Jabara, and Terry Nunn next to Deborah Winger and Jeff Goldblum. And then no one else.
It's funny, that fact took my breath away. But I also noticed that we were talking about Paul Jabara. I was going down the IMDb rabbit hole, and I saw under his top four on IMDb, the number two movie was Eraser. After Thank God It's Friday, and I was like, what the fuck, Eraser? And then I realized it's because he wrote It's Raining Men, which happens to be on the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, no, his soundtrack credits are super long because the songs that he's written, he wrote several classics. The one thing in his history that just baffles me that I really wish I could have seen is they apparently have workshopped at one point a decade ago a musical based on all of his songs, a jukebox musical based on the stuff that he wrote. And I kind of want to see what that looks like because his musical history is kind of interesting and kind of all over the map in the best way. And of course, you know, It's Raining Men is one of my favorites. You know, me and Matt Lerner, former film critic turned, distributor, used to perform that annually at Fantastic Fest. And it was a favorite of ours to do. Matt Lerman, not Lerner. It's an interesting, interesting group of people in this weird little movie.
I want to talk about the very beginning of this movie because we should have known that we were going to be in for some disco hijinks when the Columbia logo starts dancing.
I always forget about that until I watch it. Yeah, they animate the Columbia logo to start discoing.
And then we're taking through a montage of people who just really need the weekend. They're so ready for this work week to be over, and they are thanking God that it is, in fact, Friday.
Thank God it's Friday.
The first is, of course, we see Leatherman. We don't know that that's Leatherman yet, but he's working in the...
Oh, you know Leatherman when you see him.
Well, we don't know that's his name yet. we just know him as a guy dancing around in the garment district who gets a rack of clothes stolen by a biker. Why?
Comedy.
What? Because comedy. And then we see a dental hygienist who... obviously sends out the last patient of the day and she puts on a fun wig and you're like, oh, she's going to go out and have fun. And then she takes a huge fuck off hit of nitrous oxide.
And she is the most unhinged character in the movie. Like she is the one who's really just living in a completely different dimension. And you know who she reminds me of and who she probably was inspired by is she seems a lot like the disco granny who was famous at 54. The woman who would come in a wig every night was always really just out of her mind and was in her, you know, in her late eight. Have you seen 54?
I don't think I have.
You know, 50, take a drink, Junkies. 54 is a movie we're going to cover in the future, particularly the director's cut, which came out a few years ago, because the director's cut of that movie is brilliant. The original movie was fluff, but interesting fluff, and the director's cut has a lot of soul. The Weinsteins butchered that movie, and the director's cut is a really, really fantastic film, and it's based on, you know, true events, and the disco granny was a character that was really there in 54, and that's who I think this is based off of, except they make her younger so that she can be the foil for this married couple. And creating that whole interesting situation. But yeah, she is... like she's a dental hygienist who puts on this wig, takes that big huff, and from that moment on, she's just pulling drugs out of all of her pockets at all different times, and she knows exactly how to control your night. So like she gives the guy two downers and so he can mellow out, and as he starts to drift off, she gives him some uppers to level him out. He's out of his mind on drugs he's never done.
Yeah, it does seem like she got her dentist degree from the same medical school that gave Michael Jackson's doctor his degree.
That's dark.
She's handing out drugs left and right.
That's dark.
Is that pulling them out of her Mary Poppins bag? It is nuts. By the way,
is Mary Poppins cool?
I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. No. I do find it interesting that this movie, Thank God It's Friday, has garnered a reputation because it won an Oscar for Best Song. So according to critics like Leonard Maltin, this is the worst movie to ever win an Oscar.
Because they haven't seen Crash. Are we like, no, first of all, no, there are far worse movies to receive an Oscar than Thank God It's Friday, for fuck's sake. That sounds like slight bitterness, like, you know, not appreciating at the times you think it celebrates culture that you thumb your nose at. There are significantly worse movies, especially through Best Song, that have won Oscars. Thank God It's Friday is far from the worst.
I would agree with that. I also, interestingly enough, we mentioned Deborah Winger. I didn't realize this. This is, in fact, her first movie. Like, the first...
Oh, that makes sense. She's super young.
...big appearance of Deborah Winger, and probably why she's 12th billed. But yeah, I can't get over Jeff Goldblum in this movie.
Okay, so let's talk about Goldblum. Goldblum is sleazy as fuck.
I kind of like sleazy Goldblum. Like, that's one of my favorite things
about... Well, sleazy Goldblum is usual Goldblum, let's be honest.
Yeah, but I mean, there's like kind of creepy Goldblum who still wants to get laid, and then there's like Ian Malcolm.
You're really
clearly hitting on a married woman. Like,
you're really, really seduced by young, sexy swinger Goldblum, aren't you?
Oh, I don't think I've made a secret of that.
No. I'm just laying it out there before we put the nitro back in the box.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, it's he is really magical in here, and he's got this great sub joke that he's attached to. He rolls up in a Camaro, and he parks the Camaro and then covers it because he was that douchebag. Yeah. Like, from the get-go, you know who this is. He's the guy who parks in the parking lot and then puts the cover over the car.
He also has a license plate that says Big One.
Yes.
Which I probably refers to the fact that Jeff Goldblum's like 6'7".
Also, I found amusing because I was recently in London for the Clark Award. And we were staying at the hotel right across the Thames from where they had the 25-foot-tall giant Goldblum.
The big one.
The big one.
Yeah.
And so if you can hop in my Twitter feed and see pictures of me and my wife with a giant shirtless Jeff Goldblum for the 25th anniversary of Jurassic Park. And
hallelujah.
Yeah. And so I saw the big one, and that just instantly made me giggle because it's a giant Jeff Goldblum.
Young Jeff Goldblum looks like a smarmy Ichabod Crane.
Yeah.
And he's dressed like the devil in this movie. And he owns this disco called The Zoo, which we haven't described to you yet. I feel like we have to. This is a disco on theme. Let's just put it that way.
And it's a cheesy theme.
Oh my fuck. This looks like the mold that they carved the Rainforest Cafe out of. Like, it is that level of kitsch. Like, it is so ridiculous. Like, the actual the DJ booth is on top of an egg with bird feet coming out of it that's being held by giant gorilla hands. There's a guy who's Tarzan who swings across the dance floor.
Like once an hour to
full-on Weissmuller. Full-on Weissmuller.
There is the guy operating the elevator is wearing a monkey suit.
We need to talk about the elevator operator. I have so many questions.
You have questions and thoughts?
I have thoughts and questions about this elevator operator. And in fact, this elevator operator led to possibly the greatest Jeff Goldblum quote that no one has ever heard, which is, "I pay you to look like a monkey and run the elevator, not one or the other." Jeff Goldblum says this in a major motion picture.
In a major motion picture. An Oscar-winning motion picture.
Oscar-winning motion picture. "I pay you to look like a monkey and run the..." He's mad because the elevator operator, who's forced to dress like a gorilla, has taken the head off because it's hot and it's making him break out. He doesn't care. Put the head on because, again, I pay you to look like a monkey and run an elevator, not one or the other.
You know, I've just been reminded of this. I think this may be one of the only Oscar-winning films we've ever covered on this show, and it's Thank God It's Friday.
Oddly enough, Top Gun also won for Best Song, so...
And what song was that?
Take My Breath Away.
There it is.
Of course, the Oscar ended up going to Giorgio Moroder for composing the music.
Well, because Moroder is a fucking genius.
Moroder is amazing. Like, Moroder is the reason that, despite all of the things I know are wrong with Scarface, I will still watch Scarface. Like, that score, and I think Drew McWeeny summed it up perfectly when he called it fitting to this podcast,
a disco in hell,
is exactly what the score for Scarface sounds like. And this place kind of looks like a disco in hell. It is nuts. But
it's a weird fucking club that doesn't make any fucking sense.
And I think you're right. I think somebody saw the first cut of this movie, some producer, and said it needs more jokes. Because Gorilla Elevator Operator also has an ADR joke. When people are getting off the elevator, you hear him say, hey, if anyone's going to the bar, get me a banana daiquiri. Oh, yuck, 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 yuck. And
No, this is that all the ADR in this movie feels like punch up.
Yeah.
It feels like what Patton Oswalt has famously talked about, that, you know, the famous room of six, where there were six comedians that the companies would call up, and they would all get together and hang out in a room together, and they'd be shown this movie, and they'd be like, okay, so we need to punch this up. And they're like, do we need to rewrite this? No, we need jokes that we can have happen off screen to make this funny. And so they had to come up with stuff like, oh, I fell down on my boom boom.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much every joke from Frozen. I loathe Disney's Frozen. And part of the reason I loathe Disney's Frozen is when you watch it, that's all it is. Like, everything with the snowman in that movie everything with Olaf happens off screen. He's like, oh, I fell down. And it's the entire movie is filled with that. But yeah, that's what this feels like through this whole movie. Every joke, because there are no jokes in this movie. Otherwise, they're not really jokes. You know, so the things that are happening are that I guess you might kind of think are funny in 1978 are just frustrating things happen to other people that are preventing them from having a great time.
So one thing specifically I find interesting is that there is a joke in this movie. It's a classic sitcom joke where, she's dancing with this guy, and another guy comes up and says to them, like,
oh, yes,
if I cut in. And and the other guy's like, no, I don't mind at all. And then the two guys start dancing together. And what's
I think that's a joke from Wonder Bar. I think that's like a classic, classic pre-code joke.
Yeah. And I've seen it used in dozens of sitcoms. But something that's great about it is, like, there are so many different references to gay culture in this movie that doesn't have the amount of gay panic as other movies in this era, or in movies even into the 80s had.
Well, but that's because that was the whole thing with the disco era, was the disco era was a moment where in this country, everybody for just like a year and a half thought, oh, it's going to be okay that we're out now. Like, this is going to be fine. And then, of course, the Reagan era happened, and no, it's not fine. And lots of homophobia for years after that. But there was this point where in disco, it's like, hey, we're all free to be free. The free love generation gave way to free love for everybody. And hey, we're all going to kind of settle down and get our jobs. But you're free to be who you want and love who you want, as long as you're happy and love who you want. And that changed. But yeah, the disco era, that's what's so interesting about this movie, is this movie was made smack dab in the middle when Hollywood thought and disco culture thought, hey, it's going to be okay to be gay. And then, of course, you know, 5 years later, when I would be watching this in rotation on HBO, where it played like this was the movie they played after Beastmaster. And I'm not kidding. Like, I saw this movie a lot when I was a kid because it was always on HBO, which is how I grew a love for it. But yeah, it was very weird, you know, at the time that was, you know, that fell into an era where all of this entire era was mocked and looked at as this age driven entirely by cocaine, which oddly enough, there's no cocaine in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, of all the movies you'd think that would be doused in cocaine.
There's one scene where I feel like we can only assume what he's snorting is cocaine. When you know, manic pixie dental hygienist gives a radical Jewish stereotype a vial, and she just says, sniff this.
Oh, no, that's one of those wake-up things. Have you never used one of those? Like, one of those...
You mean cocaine? No, I have not.
No, one of those where you break the tab and it wakes you the fuck up.
Smelling salts?
Yeah, smelling salts.
No, because I've never been knocked unconscious, so...
Yeah, you've never had a... Yeah, but you've never had a 13-year-old buddy who's like, hey, sniff this, and it's smelling salts?
I am getting sick and tired of you telling me stories about all your 13-year-old friends who said to you, hey, sniff this, because it's becoming a theme off mic, and I'm just saying I'm a little uncomfortable. That's all I'm going to say.
Look, I'm just going to say I didn't have a boring life, all right?
Hey, sniff this equates to a very exciting life. That's lessons I've learned from...
Man Cargill.
So let me ask you this question. Just radically changing subjects. The Big Chill. Does The Big Chill take place in the 60s or?
No, Big Chill takes place in the 80s.
Okay.
Big Chill is very much of its time.
There's a lot of 60s music.
There's a lot of 60s music because that's when those people were in college.
Yeah.
So all of that music is going back to their youth. But that movie's happening. The Big Chill happens at the time that Big Chill takes place,
because
when it was filmed.
I'm just remembering that Jeff Goldblum, in that movie, his dream is to open a nightclub. And part of me wonders if he wants to open a nightclub because right after college, he got the chance to own a nightclub and it didn't go super well because it was Zoo. So
so in your headcanon, they're the same character?
Yeah.
Or it's the character before he opens Zoo?
Yeah. There's a lot of ways you can interpret that, and it's all terrifying. But yeah, the music is great. The stories, like all of the Happen One Night stories, are so much fun.
And they're rewarding.
Some of them get great, is exactly what I was going to say, get great payoffs. I think the story of, so Jeff Goldblum is directed by the DJ to this married woman who he begins to immediately start fawning over and just seducing the hell out of. And her husband, who doesn't want to be there, takes exception to it and starts dancing and taking drugs with manic pixie dental hygienist. And the two of them find each other again because the drugs wear off and the husband realizes, like, oh my God, where's my wife? Like, this is ridiculous. And she's about to leave with Jeff Goldblum. And he goes out to the parking lot and confronts Goldblum. And he's at this point, like, he is no longer a pushover. And he's going to tell this guy exactly what's up. And starts whacking his car with this pepper grinder. And the car begins to fall apart entirely.
Now, this is the joke that's been going on through the whole movie, is when many people have appeared in this film, they've accidentally run into Jeff Goldblum's covered car. And because it's covered, nobody could see how much damage has happened to it. So this car has been hit like 3 or 4 times. Leatherman runs into it. The guy in the cotton shirt with Paul Jabara runs into it. Like it gets knocked the fuck around. And so he hits it with his pepper grinder and the fucking thing just collapses and falls apart. And of course, everybody's fine with that. And nobody is shocked for some inexplicable reason.
It's like a Three Stooges gag, the way this car falls apart.
It really is.
And it's great. Like, I love it. I also thought that the relationship that Deborah Winger kind of ends up in the end of this movie is really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
The girl's winning the dance contest with Leatherman and then deciding that instead of going home, they're just going to go to the next dance contest at like 3 a.m.,
That's one of the weirder kind of, Leatherman, this, you know, 30 something, you know, day worker ends up running off into the middle of the night with a couple of teenage girls, who are underage to take them to another club.
But you know, what's odd? Like, I never got the sense from his performance that he was like sexually attracted to them. Because he is just so, like, his fetish is his own dancing.
That is true.
That is like his sexual orientation is spin.
Is internal.
Yes.
It's looking at myself in leather. That is my, I sexually identify as a leather suit.
I sexually identify as 1-2 cha-cha-cha. So that's, I mean, so I don't know, like maybe that's why it never struck me as that, but it is kind of strange. And then of course, I love the bookend of Donna Summer singing Last Dance and then having the Last Dance with the DJ as the song's playing and they're cleaning up the club. Like, that's actually a really sweet moment.
There's a lot of that in this movie. I mean, like, you mentioned Deborah Winger. At the beginning of the movie, when we first see Deborah Winger, she's walked out of this hot dog stand with some food and she's accidentally messed up her friend's dress and freaked out and thrown a hamburger out the window and it flies into the next car and hits the guy she's going to end up with.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, through the course of the craziness of the night, they end up together and, you know, all of these stories wrap up interestingly in some way, shape or form. And it all goes in a circle. Like when we first meet Jeff Goldblum, he is covering up his car so it doesn't get damaged. And when we leave him, his car has just fallen apart. Everything in this movie is very well structured. The characters are very well drawn. It is a really interestingly put together movie that just has some elements to it that are so dated and kind of come from some poor filmmaking. Mm-hmm. In terms of the filmmakers, like, I think the most interesting person in this is one of the producers, Lauren Shuler. She's one of the associate producers on this. You guys would better know her as Lauren Shuler Donner, as in she would marry Richard Donner and end up producing the X-Men movies and a ton of other films that you've seen. She is like geek elite and has overseen tons of stuff. And this is one of her early fucking producing gigs.
Which is so disappointing we didn't get an X-Men movie in this era, because you know Jeff Goldblum would have been Nightcrawler and it would have been amazing to see him in blue makeup.
Dude, I would kill for them to do a late 70s era disco era X-Men movie, because you know there's one X-Men that's going to fucking show up in there. You know it's going to be fucking Dazzler, and it's going to be fucking awesome. And they could finally rectify history and make Dazzler the way she was envisioned, which
here
was based on Donna Summer.
Yeah, Donna Summer would be Dazzler. John Travolta would be Cyclops.
No, originally she was inspired by Donna Summer.
Oh, no, I know. Because I've heard this.
But because it's fucking true. Because it's awesome. And you brought up X-Men Disco.
You're right.
You set the story up, fucker.
You and then you got up on your Coke box and just went to town on this.
I just did
again.
A couple of lines and drank some fucking iced coffee, and I'm ready to fucking disco and talk about X-Men's Dazzler and everything that went wrong with the re-envisioning of Dazzler.
I just really want a disco era X-Men movie where you have Dazzler and you have Jeff Goldblum as Nightcrawler and you have Travolta as Cyclops.
I kind of want Wolverine with a Coke spoon.
Oh, yeah.
I want the Coke spoon and the open shirt with the fly collar.
Oh, 1,000%. Oh, my God, you guys, they're not lasers. They're percussive energy that come out of my eyes. Oh, my
they're
God.
They're not heat blasts.
It's not a heat blast.
It comes from the fourth dimension.
People keep getting this confused. I do not know why. This needs to happen. We need to somehow make this happen retroactively. Okay, so here's the question. Who of the 70s era with the open shirt, the hairy chest, the Coke spoon, and at this point definitely would have gone for the like little ball of fury? Is it still Bob Hoskins? Are we still talking about Bob Hoskins as Wolverine in 1978?
I think so.
I really
think we're looking at Bob Hoskins at that point. I mean, Bob Hoskins or that era, we could also probably get away with Christopher Walken.
That's true. Christopher Walken has
wow, Bob.
I'm the best at what I do. What I do is not pretty. Chop chop, snick snick. Yeah, no, I would pay all the dollars.
I would pay all the dollars to fucking see young Christopher Walken playing Wolverine. That is a thing that would happen. Yeah, all my dollars. Here they go.
Your arms are going to break. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. Obviously, this is where we should go with this. So I'm going to recommend, now stick with me on this, a Panama Punch. Now, a Panama Punch, for those of you who don't know, is one of the signature cocktails of the Rainforest Cafe. It is Don Q 151 rum, Meyer's Original Dark Rum, peach schnapps, 99 bananas, creme de cassis, orange, and pineapple juices. So if you're going to go to 99 luft bananas, in fact. If you're going to go to a disco that just feels like you're dancing inside of a Rainforest Cafe, why not? If you can get a drink at the bar, because this movie will tell you it's notoriously difficult, you should order the Panama Punch. So that's my junk food pairing for this movie.
Perfection. Perfection. The one thing I will point out about junk food pairing, did you notice the drink that our little garbage man drank at the bar when
I
he went
not,
up?
I did not, no.
Boilermaker.
Was it really?
He went with a Boilermaker. Yeah, God, he dropped the whiskey right in the beer and chugged it down, and that's when the girl walks up.
You know how I know he's a half pint? Because he's not drinking a quadruple Boilermaker.
That's right.
Which, again, we can't legally advocate that anybody actually
attempts. You want a quadruple Boilermaker?
What does that even mean? We don't know. Guys, thank you so much for joining us for Thank God It's Friday.
On Wednesday. Unless you waited till Friday, and then God bless you. Thank God.
Or if you didn't, listen to it again on Friday. Why not? Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, @MassaWyrm, MassaWyrm.
awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or of course Junk Food is at Junk Food Cinema. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We actually do have an Instagram now. I'm trying to put more updates onto it, so that's just Instagram/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And of course, if you really like the show...
I mean, really like the show.
If you like this show more than Cargill and I like the idea of a 70s-era X-Men movie with Travolta and Bob Hoskins and Christopher Walken and Jeff Goldblum and Dazzler, played by Donna Summer.
If you like it more than I like talking about Dazzler being inspired by Donna Summer.
You can go to patreon.com/junk. I don't think anyone's going to like anything more than you like that. But you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and contribute to... That's how you guys financially support the show. We very much appreciate you doing that. It has been a tremendous help, and please continue to do so. And if not, please help spread the word. And I just want to remind you that this is Junk Food Cinema, and as I said at the top of the show, everything else is bullshit.